Good afternoon. You're listening to The Trend. And before we dive into today's social media storm, let's have a roundup of this week's local news. Today is the deadline for interested parties to submit proposals for an Indiana University Medical Center in Southwest Indiana. We'll have that detailed report during All Things Considered this afternoon. And investigators say an electric car heater on a bedroom baseboard apparently sparked a house fire that killed a mother and 8 children in Muhlenberg County. The father and another daughter escaped the flames and are being treated at a Nashville hospital. The tragedy has shaken the area, where many flags have been lowered to half-staff. The Indiana House approved a revised version of a proposed constitutional amendment on same-sex marriage this week. House members removed a sentence from HJR 3 that could ban civil unions or eliminate domestic partner benefits. Despite the move, the Indiana Senate could restore the language and force another vote in the House. But if both chambers pass the revised proposal, the same-sex marriage issue would not go before voters until 2016 at the earliest. Indiana's jobless rate has dropped to its lowest level in more than 5 years. And construction of the Interstate 69 extension has reached the Bloomington area. Crews are preparing to cut down trees along a 9-mile stretch of the State Road 37. The tree work should wrap up by March 31st, and officials expect construction on the 21-mile section between Bloomington and Martinsville to start later this year. The section of I-69 between the Crane Naval Warfare Center and Bloomington should be completed before the end of this year. The former Evansville-Vanderburgh School Administration building will be turned into a restaurant, credit union, office space, and fitness center. The City Council voted 9-0 this week to rezone the former school building behind the Civic Center. The EVSC moved out of the building 3 years ago and into offices on Walnut Street. The Evansville Courier and Press reports that the building will undergo about $2 million in interior and exterior renovations. This is WNIN News. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back here on The Trend talking social media.
Support comes in part from Evansville Day School, partnering with parents to offer a student-centered education program for students junior pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. More information at evansvilledayschool.org or at 812-476-3039.
All right, you're listening to The Trend here on WNIN. I'm Cass Harrington, joined by two Twitter gurus, I must say. I've got Zach Parsons in the studio, who is a digital marketing architect at Lieberman. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
And I have Dr. Peter Rosen, Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at Evansville University. University of Evansville, excuse me.
Thanks for having me, Cass.
And today's program is literally a social media storm. And if listeners, if you hear the buzzing of phones on today's program, that's because we're tweeting here in the studio. And you can tweet us, actually. It's handle is at The Trend Talks. And I understand, too, that we have listeners who may not be on Twitter or on social media, and they're kind of wary of the monster that it may be. So our phone lines are also open right now. And Zach, why don't you give us those numbers?
That phone number is 812-426-7100. And I just want to say, Cass, you are doing a fantastic job at this. You and John have taken over for Micah, whom we all loved so well. And I just want to encourage you to keep up the good work
with the trend.
And you got a couple fans right here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And we are certainly having fun. I've never seen so much tweeting going on in this studio. But this is something that I want to convey to listeners. It's something relevant to, in ways we may not realize. So later in this segment, we'll hear from a filmmaker from Evansville who's using a crowdsourcing website to get his film out there to the public. And here with you two, we're going to talk about the professional implications of social media and also personal relationships and social psychology, which is going to be very interesting. So first, to round out this conversation, Dr. Peter Rosen, I understand you have done extensive research on Twitter and the hireability of people with Twitter profiles. Give us a quick rundown, if you will.
Right. So in the past, I've done some research on Facebook and in exactly that context, the job performance. Can you predict someone's job performance from their Facebook profile? And I was on the show with Micah back in March of 2012. The latest research is called the use of Twitter profiles to assess personality and hireability. So it's a quick study on can people who don't know you at all, so we call them zero acquaintance raters, they have no idea who you are, can they get on your Twitter profile? And number one, can they predict your personality?
And what did you find? Can they?
And we found that they can. So we looked at six different personality traits, what we call the big five: conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, openness to experience, and neuroticism.
And then we added one just for the Twitter users,
which is narcissism. We found there's a lot of people who are wild narcissists who use Twitter, have 20,000 plus tweets. It's pretty crazy.
Certainly. Well, and you're a lot of times talking about yourself or promoting yourself on Twitter. So
you tend to do that. You have 140 characters and you use them all about you.
So how were you able to measure these personality traits?
So that's great. So we had 567 UE students participate in the study. Of those, we had 152 that made the final cut. Those were students that filled out our survey. It's a personality survey. They also had 200 or more tweets, and they had public accounts. So they didn't protect their tweets. Anybody in the world could see what they were tweeting about. So 152 made that cut. I had three PhD students in organizational behavior from Louisiana State University look at all 152 profiles and then answer the same questions that the students did about their personality. So what do you think the personality is of the user of the Twitter profile?
Really interesting. And so they were, the profiles you looked at were public profiles. Were some of them like newsmakers, famous people?
No, all of these were UE students. Oh, okay. So 152 UE students. Right. So we had the three trained raters from Louisiana State. Uh-huh. In addition, what made my study sort of interesting is I had three HR professionals rate the same 152 profiles on whether or not they would hire these students.
Wow.
Now, that would be a general type position and not any job specific.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's look at trends here. Like what sorts of characteristics in a Twitter feed was a company looking for?
Right. So what I had the both the hireability and the personality raters do was look at the entire profile. So that entire profile is not just the tweets, which is very important, the pictures, the header photo, the background. You can customize the background. Mm-hmm. Conversations that they were in, lists they belong to, photos and videos they uploaded. So there's a lot of stuff on there. People tend to think of Twitter as just the microblogging, 140 characters. You can put a lot of stuff out there.
Hmm. What about the usernames themselves?
This is Zach Parsons, by the way, chiming in.
Sorry, yeah, you can tell our voices apart, I hope.
Sure,
I
sure.
I don't know. Yeah, what about the names? Did you guys study folks?
Everything was taken into consideration by these raters, especially the HR raters. As to the level of professionalism that user displayed. So everything was on the table.
This is fascinating, by the way.
Okay, so that was the first thing. Could we assess your personality? And the answer is yes, on all six of the personality traits that were studied. The second thing is, do the raters agree on what they see? If they don't agree on what they see, it cannot be used in the hiring and screening process at all. So both the personality raters, the three personality raters, and separately the three HR raters who assessed hireability agreed on what they were seeing. That gives it more validity.
First of all, why don't we give out the numbers in case someone's listening, they want to maybe start a Twitter page or they're wondering how will my Twitter page affect my job? What's our studio number?
Yeah, please give us a call, 812-426-7100, or you can tweet us if you're already on Twitter at The Trend Talks.
Thank you, Zach. I like how slowly you read those numbers. when a company is looking at someone's profile, are there things that maybe turn someone off?
Yes, there are. Okay, so some of the things that we were looking for, or some of the things that the raters told us they were looking at, profanity was probably the worst thing you could do. And it pointed to the fact that you are not an agreeable person. An agreeable person is someone that gets along with others and works in groups, probably. So one of the biggest things they were looking for was how agreeable someone was. The second biggest thing they were looking for was the mood of the user, the mood of the tweeter. That pointed to how neurotic they were. Huh. Neuroticism is a measure of how they handle stress and their mood,
which
their general outlook on life.
Which isn't necessarily always a bad thing. I look at leaders in the world, and if they're kind of neurotic, sometimes they're effective.
Well, so we don't want someone who's consistently in a bad mood, self-deprecating all that. We want to work with someone, especially in corporations, but that like themselves and they like their like others and they like their lives. Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, the big thing they were looking for was conscientiousness, the level of professionalism they displayed, how reliable and how dependable that user was. They tended to get that from their pictures, their followers. Mm-hmm. Who are they following? Are they following more professional organizations or just random people? And their activity and responsibility level. The more activities they're involved with, the more responsible they were, the higher they got on that professionalism scale.
So let's relate this then to maybe a college student who's listening, or a young professional, or even someone who may be out of a job right now. Can Twitter be a helpful tool?
Twitter can be your friend. This is not just to eliminate candidates. It's also to identify candidates that might be suitable for our organization. More positive you are, the better. The more professional you are, the better. And the more you have a positive outlook on life, tend to get along with others, and show that you're an agreeable person, that's what led to higher ability ratings.
That's fascinating. Well, aside from Twitter, I mean, LinkedIn is very popular among professional populations. And I've been curious, is that something you've looked at? Possibly, I don't know, the good or the bad?
Well, of course, we've looked at that. We have another study on LinkedIn. It's under review right now at a journal. We can, you know, get into that at a later time. But we've looked at how organizations are using all of the big three. That would be Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter.
Well, wait till Google Plus shows up and starts muscling in there. It might be the big four in a couple of years, right?
It could be the big four.
I don't know if I can handle another platform right now.
But we are really pushing the use of LinkedIn to the college students, and especially in the School of Business. We think that that's sort of the wave of the future. Hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. One thing that kind of sparked this conversation is I was looking at breakups, actually, and I was wondering, you know, when someone leaves their job or they get fired and they have to update that on LinkedIn, how do you go about that in a positive way, as you keep emphasizing?
That's a good one. But I think you need to look at the future, and the future is going to be better than what the past was. but you do bring up a good point. Another thing that we just talked about in one of my classes was, what happens if someone has a corporate Twitter account and they have thousands of followers? We had an example where a person had 17,000 followers that they amassed through their professional connections, and then they left the company. Who does that Twitter account belong to?
Huh. Yeah.
Good questions.
Fascinating question.
Still remains to be studied, but I'm very interested in what you're doing.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Peter Rosen, Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at the University of Evansville. We're going to next hear from Elizabeth Elsesser, who is an assistant professor in communication and culture at Indiana University. Quick break.
Support comes in part from Raven Tire and Auto Service, a proud sponsor of WNIN programming. Raven offers a selection of tire brands including Michelin and Goodyear, along with complete auto service and recommended maintenance by trained technicians. Information on the web at raventire.com. We're brewing a social media storm on the trend here on WNIN-FM. If you're a social media cynic who may be curious about dipping your toes into the Twitter pond, why don't you give us a call at 812-426-7400. One of our experts can help you out.
You're listening to The Trend on WNIN. You just heard my secret. Visualize margaritas. That's how you learn to have fun in the studio. Anyway, so coming up, we're going to listen to an interview I did with Elizabeth Elsesser, Assistant Professor in Communication and Culture at Indiana University. She's currently working on a book titled Restricting Access, on how people with disabilities are using social media. Let's have a listen. I understand that you have focused some research on using social media or digital platforms for people with disabilities. Could you talk about that?
My research is largely focused on digital media, including social media, video games, YouTube videos, that many people with disabilities use and use regularly, but that also present barriers for people with specific disabilities. So if we think about something like YouTube videos, they've been actually fantastic for members of deaf communities who use them for sign language communication. But they're also really terrible in terms of watching a mainstream video that is almost never captioned. So that sort of give and take between the opportunities of digital media and the ways that digital media create access barriers has been the focus of my research.
There's limitations in some aspects.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, the focus of our program this week is social media, how it's simplifying our lives on one end, and then how it's complicating things on another. So that's a really interesting dynamic for people who may have disabilities.
Yeah, definitely.
So what other cases have you looked at?
Well, I've done a lot of work on the basic idea of web accessibility, which is developing or coding digital media in a way that it can be used by people with disabilities who are using what's called assistive technology. That includes things like screen readers, which read the content of a web page to someone with a visual impairment. And if a web page isn't coded in specific ways, then screen readers don't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and literally, this is like a voice reading the text on a page.
Yes, it's just like if you take your iPhone and you turn on Siri and ask her to read you something.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally the same thing.
Okay.
And in fact, a lot of blind people love the iPhone for that reason, because Siri does work as a screen reader and does work as a dictation device and allows for really easy access to a mainstream computer technology, which has been hard to come by for many blind people over the years.
Are there any concerns that, with the speed and the momentum that social media has grown, we're becoming more and more dependent on it in some ways. I was talking to my friend the other day about, I just want to leave Facebook, but I can't, because I would lose connection with so many people. But do you fear or see maybe in the future that, some people might get lost if it's not catered to their specific disability or need?
I think there's a lot of concern about that, and also a lot of attention to it at the government level recently, because technologies have been developing and changing so quickly, especially when we talk about social media or mobile media. It's been really hard for policy to keep up. A lot of our technology policies were written in the late 90s, mm-hmm. and thus they talk about technologies that we don't even use anymore.
Right.
So instead, what we've seen since about 2010 is the federal government trying to step in and say, okay, if we're going to develop these new technologies, develop them in these ways with these goals. So, for instance, instead of saying you must do this specific thing, they tend to say now that you must develop technology in a way that it is perceivable for people with a range of needs, or that it is operable for people with a range of abilities. And so you've seen that come up in sort of anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, innovations in discussions with the Department of Justice, but also in what's called the 21st Century Communication and Video Accessibility Act, which is quite a mouthful.
Yeah.
But that is entirely aimed at encouraging mobile media development and other forms of digital media to be compatible with closed captioning and other forms of disability access, so that we don't have to go back and fix them later. They can be sort of put on an inclusive path from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you know of any, I'm sure you do, standout examples like apps or social media platforms that are really guiding the way for, you know, someone who may be blind or paraplegic, just really exceptional things that are improving people's lives?
Yeah, definitely. One thing that I think is a really fantastic example is an iPhone app that's called Proloco to Go. And it's one of the most expensive apps in the App Store. It costs, I want to say, roughly $200.
Oh, my gosh.
But what it does is act as a communication tool for people with cerebral palsy or autism or other disabilities that affect their speech or ability to communicate, where people have in the past used things like speech boards, which mm-hmm. are laminated pieces of paper with specific words or images on them. Mm-hmm. This is an application that allows them to have a much broader vocabulary using a really common technological device, and offers much improved communication potential. And I said, right, that it's expensive. It's $200 for the app on top of whatever you paid for your iPhone or iPad. Comparable assistive technologies have run closer to $2,000.
Wow.
So it's a much, much cheaper alternative and a much, much more easily available alternative. I know of people who have used it to essentially write entire speeches and have them delivered by the automatic voice, allowing them thus to easily communicate with a wide audience or give a talk at a conference or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, do you have any projections or a hypothesis for where this is headed?
In some ways, we're looking at a really exciting point in digital media in general and specifically related to including people with disabilities, in that we've reached a point where these things are so mainstream that there is no, there's no tailoring them to a niche audience, right? This isn't just technology for nerds. This isn't something where we can assume that only the highly literate are going to be accessing it. Mm-hmm. Instead, we've reached a point where these things are so mainstream that all kinds of customizations are becoming much more common. You have the ability with something like Google Plus to customize your circles and customize your social engagement. We have a sense that personalization and customization are really important parts of social and mobile media right now. And personalization and customization leave themselves open to including accessibility options. So if you have the option of saying, oh, well, I'd really prefer that the text on my Facebook page be larger, that's something that can appeal to people in a wide variety of circumstances with a wide variety of needs. Again, if we look at something like Siri, it's impossible to tell whether Siri is an assistive device for someone with a disability who needs to be able to use voice commands, or a convenience device for people who are driving or can't type for some reason, or just like asking Siri ridiculous questions.
Right, just for entertainment.
So, yeah, exactly. So we have this sort of blurring that I think bodes really well for the future of these media.
Great. Well, Liz, thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Trend here on WNIN. We're having a social media party And we're also answering your questions. Maybe you're still a little skeptical about Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. Well, we have two specialists here in the studio, Dr. Peter Rosen from UE and Zach Parsons, a digital marketing architect, which is a fabulous title. Well, and it turns out we do have a caller on the line. Let me throw out those numbers one more time. If you have a question, it's 812-426-7400. So, caller, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Hi there. How are you?
Pretty good. This is a question for Dr. Rosen.
Okay. And what's your name, caller?
I'm sorry?
What's your name?
Parker.
Okay, Parker. Well, take it away, Dr. Rosen. Or actually, ask your question. That would be a good start.
What does, social media actually do for the average Joe like myself in building my reputation?
Sure. I think what you can do, Parker's your name? Yeah, Parker. I'm sorry. Parker, I think what you could do is demonstrate your value proposition to future employers. What do you have to offer, your knowledge of the field, and things of that nature?
Okay.
Do you have a specific kind of goal in mind, Parker?
Not really. I use Twitter sparingly, not as much as I know Dr. Rosen does. But, I use it kind of here and there, but I just wanted to kind of know his opinion on, like, what does it do for the average person that, you know, doesn't have a lot of followers like myself?
This is Zach Parsons here. I would recommend just kind of doing some searches of hashtags of things that you find personally interesting, different topics, and then find out what conversation is already happening, and then responding to people. It could be good or bad, to let them know that you're also interested. A lot of times those interactions lead to follows and relationships. And, pretty soon you might have people asking those questions of you. And that's one way that it can start.
And I have a quick example of that, actually. When I was in Chicago, I was walking downtown and a street was blocked off because there was a film being done, and it was actually a Bollywood film. And there were thousands of people on the sidewalk, and I was standing there in the crowd. I had no idea who the actor was, what was going on. And I tapped someone on the shoulder, and she looked at me, and she goes, "Hello, it's Doom 3. I don't know what that is. So on my way back to work, I tweeted, just walked on the set of Doom 3, hashtag Bollywood. I got 300 followers from India, from Bollywood News, and
wow.
Then they were tweeting me back saying, "Where are they going next?" You know, and I said, "I don't know. I'm just a casual observer on the sidewalk." So, yeah, it's amazing how it makes the world smaller, and you can jump in on conversations going on, halfway around the world.
Yeah, I think that's one of the neatest parts about it is the fact that you don't have to have a reciprocal relationship with somebody. It can just be around a topic. And like you said, it is worldwide. Fantastic.
Well, Parker, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Parker.
Coming up next, we have an interview that my buddy John Gibson did with a local small-budget filmmaker, Kevin Chenault, who produced a movie called Different Drum. Stay tuned for that.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM and streaming online at WNIN.org. Coming up, host John Gibson talks to Kevin Chenault, a small-budget filmmaker who's using a Kickstarter campaign to release his movie on DVD. He'll talk about how crowdfunding is revolutionizing the film industry.
Yeah, that's what we're currently in our campaign, a Kickstarter campaign. We're about halfway through, and we're trying to raise funds for the DVD and Blu-ray release of our movie, Different Drum.
Now, how does the Kickstarter thing work? How do you raise this money?
Sure, it's a crowdsource funding website where it's an all or nothing platform where you, whether it be a film that you want to get funded or release, in our case, we've already made the film, but we're trying to get it released out to the public. Or whether it be a play that you want to put on or an album that you want to record, mm-hmm. You create a project on Kickstarter and then you ask people to donate, and in exchange for their donations, you get rewards that you set up.
I see. And I think you mentioned this. Now, how much of your budget have you been able to raise through this social media site?
Currently, we're at 10%, which is great. We've had a lot of support from people sharing, whether it be our Kickstarter page, actually sharing that, or sharing our Facebook page, which we have a Facebook page for our small production company called Blackstrap Pictures, which people have been sharing a lot as well. So we're at 10%. We would like to be at more, and that's what we're trying to get the word out as much as possible now, to try and make a mad dash for the finish line to try and raise 100%.
So it sounds like social media has played a big role in getting this project done.
Absolutely. Yeah, social media has been a huge help, whether it be through myself sharing links on Blackstrap Pictures Facebook or on our website, which is the same, blackstrappictures.com. Mostly it's friends of the film, people who've worked on the film, sharing it and liking our page and things like that. So getting the word out has been huge.
Now, the movie, Different Drum, without giving away too much, can you tell us a little bit about the story of the film?
Yeah, sure. It's a relationship. It's a film about a relationship between Todd and Lydia, who are the two main characters. Todd is played by Zach Zint, and Lydia is played by Isabella DeVoy. And the story takes place on the road, so it's a road trip film.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, did you shoot some of the scenes here in Evansville, in the area?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we shot about, I would say, half of the film here at home, but we started production in Des Moines, Iowa. And we started there. We drove from Des Moines to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and then from Sioux Falls to so on and so forth through the Midwest.
So it's really a road movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we filmed, we went out and did a location scout a few months before production started. We went out, myself, Tim Hallahan, who's a producer on the film, and Eddie Scully, who is a cinematographer on the film. The three of us went out location scouting and drove to Des Moines and Sioux Falls and some other places. We went to Madison, Wisconsin, and Chicago, and Milwaukee, and all of these places other than Chicago I had never been to. So I'd never been to Sioux Falls. But the script had already been written. I wrote it as Sioux Falls because a friend of mine told me a story about how great Sioux Falls was, and I said, I've got to make it there. How can I make it to Sioux Falls? So I wrote it into the script, and I said, well, I have to go now because it's in the script.
Well, how did you come up with the idea for the film? I mean, where did this all start?
Sure. Myself and Jill Nellis, we co-wrote the characters and the basic story structure of the film. And we wrote it a few years back, probably a full year before production started. And we would meet at coffee shops, mainly at Donut Bank, and we would sit down and try and hash out this idea. We had the two characters in mind, Todd and Lydia, and we just kind of hashed out certain scenes and scenarios. And then after the two of us are writing the basic structure of the film, then I took that and put it into a script form and actually wrote out the dialogue and things like that.
I see. So I guess you've had to do all of this on quite the small budget, right?
Very small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, does this does this prove that you can, go out there and make a film? A film, obviously, that involved a lot of traveling on a tiny budget that you can at least partially raise through social media?
Absolutely. Yeah. The initial budget, though, wasn't raised through through social media. But absolutely, you can make a film for next to nothing. It's a great time that we live in where you can easily access cameras and editing software. But I think that's probably the way that it's always been. You could always make a film on 8mm and mm-hmm. cut it yourself using a splicer and actually physically cut the film yourself. So I think the accessibility these days are kind of overplayed, where people say, well, it's a lot easier now, but really, you know, you could always do it. You can make films on 8mm, 16mm, and it was relatively inexpensive. Mm-hmm. It's gotten a lot more expensive now because there's film shortages where you can't shoot on film. We shot on digital. But it's proof that you can really do it. I mean, you can make a film for a lot less than what we had for this one, and we had a tiny budget. Uh-huh. So.
Well, now I understand the film that you're working with here would be going straight to DVD and Blu-ray. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, we had a local showing at Showplace North, and a few months ago, and yeah, it would be going straight to DVD, Blu-ray, which is we have a combo pack. It's a Blu-ray disc and a DVD within the same pack, which is what we're trying to raise funds to produce.
I see. Now, as far as getting it on the big screen, I mean, as you mentioned, I guess you can get a Blu-ray onto a big screen, but
absolutely,
but still,
that's how we showed it.
I got you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But no big screen release in the works, at least for like widespread distribution at this point.
That would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the obstacles in our place, mainly finances and or finding another company that would be willing to release it theatrically, is a little challenging because the film, in their eyes, the film doesn't have many marketable aspects, something that they can sink their teeth into, whether it be a named star or have played the Cannes Film Festival or South by Southwest or something. I mean, those are big things that are huge that we've tried to do, which we love. I love, and I'm sure everyone does, the idea of these festivals. They're fantastic. Yeah. But the situation that we're in now is, what do you do when you don't get accepted to those festivals?
Right.
Do you just bury the film in a closet somewhere and not even try and get it out? Or do you take it upon yourselves and try and raise money through Kickstarter and other means and try and get the film out there as any way as possible. But we would love a theatrical run.
Sure.
Yeah.
But as for now, you are, like you say, you're doing it yourself and getting it out there at least on Blu-ray and DVD.
Absolutely.
So what do you see as the long-term effects of crowdsourcing, which is what they call sites like Kickstarter?
Right.
Do you see it as a way of sort of democratizing the film industry? I mean, getting more films out there that, wouldn't make it otherwise?
Sure. Yeah. That's I've heard that term before, the democratization of filmmaking, which I've heard that before. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting term. It seems like I've read a few articles as of lately, and it seems like that there are a lot of independent films being made, especially since the submissions to these festivals that were previously mentioned have gone skyrocketed. Uh-huh. It's more challenging to get your films into these film festivals. But to me, that only says that these film festivals need to extend the length of time that they're having them.
Yeah.
If they're getting 20,000 submissions to Sundance, maybe Sundance should think about extending it a few weeks to incorporate all these other films.
Because
the want and desire for independent film is there and will always be there. It's just that the powers to be might not see it as being there. But people want independent film and foreign film. And there's a lot of films out there that are in the marketplace that don't have distribution, including it, like ours, obviously. But there's a lot of films that have played these big festivals that aren't distributed theatrically or even on DVD, which is a sad thing because we don't get to see those. Yeah, we don't get the cultural benefits of seeing these films.
We've been speaking to Kevin Chenault. He's the writer and director of the new movie, Different Drum. Thank you very much, Kevin. We appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to The Trend. That was my dear colleague, John Gibson. And so we're in the final segment of today's conversation on social media. We've been opening up our Twitter feeds and taking calls. If you want to call the studio, the number is 812-426-7400, or you can use the handle on Twitter, The Trend Talks. So we've heard how Twitter is possibly affecting the hiring process, how you can brand yourself. We just heard from that small filmmaker that social media is bringing new, maybe smaller projects into the mainstream where they were otherwise go unrecognized. And we also heard how social media is kind of giving a voice or a new platform for people with disabilities. So in this final segment, we're going to get very personal. We're going to talk relationships on a very small focus level. And I think when we're talking relationships here, we're talking about Facebook, because you get to see someone's entire history online, or and the milestones in people's lives are posted on Facebook, sometimes in an airbrushed fashion where we see only the good going on. But that doesn't leave out breakups, per se.
No, in fact, I remember...
Zach Parsons, by the way.
Sorry, Zach here. I remember when I was going through my divorce, and I was all doing all sorts of stuff on Facebook and Twitter all the time. You know, I thought, how do I announce this thing that happened in my life that's very personal? And I didn't want to just say, so I'm divorced. So it was just that matter of updating my relationship status through Facebook. You know, it was small, but it did lead to a lot of my close friends and family reaching out to me, you know, are you okay? And that was a big part of letting me kind of heal and process that. And my Facebook family, if you will, helped with that. So I think it's good. I think it's healthy to show the good and the bad, just really the real.
Any trepidation about that? It's almost, because I would fear almost my life becoming a tabloid.
Yeah, maybe a little bit, but I think hopefully folks have this desire to show people the real versions of themselves. And I think if everything that you're putting out there is just kind of positive and sunshine and rainbows, you know, people get a little sick of it, and they know that it's not all the real you. Mm-hmm. So maybe if there's a mix of things that are difficult or negative, they understand that when you put something out there, it's real.
Well, and I know you have a social psychology background. That's not right.
Organizational psychology, but yeah, I really, really latched onto the social psychology
aspect. You're giving me a puzzled look there. So I wonder, do you see any implications how this might affect our personal relationships in the future? If we're turning to Facebook or social media to make these kinds of deep updates in our lives, or even connections with other people, is there something we're losing?
Something that we're losing? Possibly. I kind of look at it more in terms of what we might be able to gain. In social psychology, there's a theory called drive theory, and it talks about how we tend to perform differently when we're aware of an audience. And so by making certain types of commitments on Facebook or Twitter or something like that, it could be actually enhancing our commitment to whatever it is that we say that we're going to follow through with. And in terms of relationships, like, you know, romantic relationships or family relationships, I do think there probably is a line somewhere where you don't need to be airing all of your dirty laundry right out there. But for some aspects of it, I think it could work to enhance relationships, especially ones that are disrupted by geography. You know, mm-hmm. We're able to keep in touch with people for much farther distances
now. And another thing, you know, relationships... starting new relationships or terminating a relationship, but also in the passing of a friend. When someone dies, a lot of times you'll find out online. I understand you have a story about that, and you think that it was an appropriate update.
Yeah, I think it was appropriate in the case. I had a friend whose longtime wife passed away, and he simply put her picture, a picture when she was healthy, up on the Facebook, and talked about how she was diagnosed with cancer the day after Christmas. They had about a 4 or 5 week period of her deteriorating, and but said he loved her, and it was inviting basically people to share in that loss at that time. So I thought it was beautiful and moving and sad, but it was a celebration of their relationship as well.
Well, that's something that I think is a beautiful aspect of social media, is regardless if someone is even here anymore, it's like they've been memorialized their life. I have friends who've died and their Facebook pages are still active. People are still writing
the
on
the birthday notifications still come.
Yeah, and their photos, you can still comment on them. And it's kind of a beautiful living testimony of that person. So
absolutely.
Peter, do you, is this something you talk about?
I have a friend, a good friend, who whose son passed away at the age of 15, and he would have turned 18 this week, and they posted photos of his life and just a celebration of his life, and they garnered thousands of comments from the followers, and it's just a great way to remember somebody.
Is this something you talk about in your classes at all?
Not really. We tend to focus more on the organizational aspects of social media use. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I wholeheartedly agree with the personal uses as well.
Yeah, it's a fine line. You know, you don't want people to, like you said, think it's like a tabloid that you're living in, and it's a place to talk smack about somebody else. Right. But you need to be honest with people if that's the level of insight you've provided into your life so far. Just keep it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you're listening to The Trend. We're talking social media. Right now we're talking relationships, but in the first segment we did talk about professional lives, hiring. If you have questions about any of these topics relating to social media, maybe you haven't treaded the waters yet, you can give us a call here in the studio. Zach, why don't you read those numbers?
Sure. It's 812-426-7400. Give us a call.
And you can tweet us at The Trend Talks. So, but yeah, when I was telling you all earlier when we were off the air that when I moved here, I was kind of surprised to see how dense professionals in Evansville. It seems they're on Facebook. At least that's where they're most active. Or, you know, it was kind of a strange transition for me to say, oh, I'm a professional. Should I friend them on Facebook? You know, how do you walk that fine line?
I think that's a tough one, too. In this community, I would agree. It seems that Facebook is kind of the dominant social media channel, even for business use. The tricky part is when you maybe don't want that person who you would have a business lunch with to maybe see, you know, pictures of your kids or something like that. So it's on a kind of on a case-by-case basis of how out there, you know, you want to be. Of course, you can set privacy settings to limit friends to certain aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. But I think it's case-by-case.
But I think we've both successfully navigated that. Our personal and our professional pages are the same. Mm. We don't have separate accounts, and it's who we are, and we're public figures, and we want people to know who we are.
Absolutely.
Well, let's cut to a quick break, and then we'll come back, give you those numbers for our studio here on The Trend.
Tweet, tweet, social media episode of The Trend. So why don't you share your stories with At The Trend Talks about how you met a friend, broke up with a girlfriend. Host Cass Harrington is about to talk with Zach Parsons about social media and how it affects relationships and behavior.
You're listening to The Trend. Again, we're talking social media on today's program. And again, this segment is focused on the more personal side of social media, particularly Facebook. And so Zach Parsons has a background in the sociological aspect of this. And I remember you had mentioned on the phone that it seems that different platforms, social media platforms, can have a different personality, even if it's the same person.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is that?
I mean, we tend to, I'm a firm believer that we have different versions of ourselves depending on who we believe our audience is. And that audience is probably going to be different on Facebook than it is on Twitter, especially if you're, you know, a teenager, which we've seen studies where teenagers are actually starting to leave Facebook. And a big part of that reason is probably because their parents and aunts and uncles and grandparents are there, and they don't want to have that level of exposure with that audience. Mm-hmm. Whereas on Twitter or Snapchat or Instagram, something like that, where their parents maybe haven't found out about it yet, they can act differently. Yeah.
Well, something I've heard is like Facebook is the private party where there's a bouncer, and then Twitter is just like the public rave where, you know, you can talk to anyone. I think that's a great example.
Yeah, Twitter's again, it can be a free for all sometimes, and we've seen some of the negative things when somebody tweets something out hastily in an angry moment and then tries to delete it, but it's too late.
Yeah.
But there's so many beautiful things that can happen on Twitter as well, bringing people together, you know, around common interests and trying to build up their community.
And speaking of which, people are doing that right now with this conversation. And Paul Sullivan just tweeted, "Suppose the real version of yourself is socially unacceptable."
I think that's an awesome way to look at it. I think you can use social media to test out different parts of yourself, to put it out there and say, okay, will I be accepted or rejected for this? And then, do I care? Maybe you don't. Maybe it's okay.
And maybe people appreciate that.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's people I follow just for their humor.
There's a thing called being countercultural, and a lot of people, myself included, would admire that. So I say he should bring it. I think I'll follow him right now.
Yeah, well, and we also have a tweet from Cindy in Carmi, and she says very few local people there or agencies even have a presence, and I'm assuming she means on Twitter. What is the value, I guess, for an agency or an organization to have that presence? We've talked about people as professionals, as individuals, but what about an organization?
Yeah, I think it's just quick contact with all of your customers. Just think about if you had a food truck, for example. I'll use Mexcellent I just love that place.
Me too.
And so, you know, when Mexcellent wants to tell its customers where they're going to be that day, they just send out a tweet. It gets directly to those people that they're trying to reach. So I think it's very powerful for businesses.
And I think you could also do a lot of social listening in on a conversation that's happening maybe about your business directly or about your industry, and do that kind of outreach where you let people know, hey, we're here, we are listening, and we'd like to engage with you.
Yeah. And if you're listening right now, we're tweeting up a storm in here. We have a few minutes left if you have a question for us. The handle is TheTrendTalks, and our studio number is 812-426-7400. Well, fellas, any final thoughts? Maybe a trend, possibly, that you see at the forefront that how this is going to affect our personal, private, professional lives?
One of the trends that I have seen, which is a great tie in there with the title of the show, done, Cass.
Thank you.
I really think Google Plus is going to start to make some waves in the next year and a half, especially as people care about showing up in Google search results. Google Plus profiles are showing up more and more, and things that are shared on a Google Plus profile will also show up with the people that you are in circles with. And if I'm talking Greek, I apologize. We can talk more off air.
We'll have information online for the listeners. And Peter, anything from your end?
No, I actually completely agree with that assessment. If you look at some of my highest ranked Google search profile mentions, it comes from my Google Plus account, and it's things I never even thought that would show up in the top 10 of searches for myself.
Yeah, they are the big boy, the big daddy, and you have to play nice with them, and that's the toy that they want us to play with right now.
Well, there you have it. Two insights from two social media gurus, and it looks like we might have a caller on the line. Well, scratch that. We're running out of time anyway.
Maybe not guru. How about aficionados?
Aficionados.
Is that all right?
I like that.
All right.
I like that. Well, thank you so much. That was Zach Parsons, digital marketing architect at Lieberman, and Peter Rosen, associate professor of management information systems at the University of Evansville. This has been quite a social media storm, fellows. This has been great.
It was fun. Thanks.
This is the end of today's trend, but of course, the conversation doesn't end here. If you're curious about a person or project mentioned on today's show, you can visit the trends page at WNIN.org. We'll also have the playlist from today's techie-sounding show. Tune in next week when John Gibson hosts The Trend at the Evansville Museum for its opening day. We'll talk then. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press, and this episode was produced by my help with help from the fabulous Mallory Klum. Steve Berger also helped out with the engineering. Thank you, Steve. And John Gibson helped with today's headlines and contributed that fabulous interview with Kevin Chenault. The theme music was written by Jeffrey Osman. And I'm Cass Harrington. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.